The Hand of Fate, written and narrated by Shirley Hyatt.
My grandmother had the gift. My mother denied it, insisting it had passed her over. But from the look in her eyes, whenever I pressed her on that subject, I was certain some kind of tragedy had been foretold that left a deep stamp of sorrow on her soul. When she was overly tired or wasn't feeling well, I could see it in her eyes. I wondered if it had robbed her of the life she might have lived. But then who's to say she hadn't lived exactly as fate intended? The trouble with being gifted is that it doesn't include a follow-up message explaining how to pick up the pieces after the prophesied event turns your world upside down. If you don't like it, it's no use trying to deny it. My mother had tried and, in my opinion, had failed. Her words were rehearsed, a play enacted for my benefit. I'm convinced my mother had carried a terrible secret that lived just behind her eyes always, until they closed to this world and a look of peace lay on her face. And now it was my turn. I thought of her burden and mine as once more I went through the metal detector, signed in, showed my ID, had my body scanned with that damned wand, my coat and handbag searched. It was ridiculous that George was being treated like a hardened criminal, George. Couldn't bring himself to kill a spider because of the vital role they played in the balance of nature. Besides, the verdict had been guilty of involuntary manslaughter, not calculated cold-blooded murder. Still, a man was dead, and it was George's fault. He wore his guilt like a softly woven cloak, refusing to take its full weight onto his shoulders. It was a method they had all adopted as ace flyers, a way to forgive themselves for the deaths of the men whose planes they had blasted out of the sky. It wasn't personal. It was war, and there was a difference. Still, men had died at their hands. Being responsible for the death of your best friend was an entirely different matter, and for George, his payment had seemed little enough. Across the metal table, my husband and I locked eyes, silently reading each other's thoughts, pretending there wasn't an armed guard standing in the corner. It was a terrible reality. His voice shook as he told me that facing each new day felt as if he was pulling a wagon uphill, through mud 2 feet deep, with one of the wheels missing. The missing wheel was Bart. There had always been the four of them, George, Bart, Sidney, and James. Four children who grew into men to move through their lives as one. College football heroes, they'd served in the Air Force together and come home with their chests full of medals to be embraced by a patriotic community that gave them the keys to the city. They'd climbed the business ladder together and as a successful team of architects had generously given back. Over the years, the men had turned their love of golf into a successful business, designing and building courses with an eye to protecting the ecosystems. The beautiful course that lay northeast of our city had an expansive clubhouse that owed its existence to them. The members installed a plaque with their names on it over the bar. But that was then. That was before. It's impossible to keep my thoughts from going back to that day, the day I had known. Retirement was just around the corner, and I couldn't wait. On Monday, we would all go to Spain and on to Greece and anywhere else we chose to go. I was looking forward to getting my husband away from his buddies for some alone time. It was a Tuesday, before the last official day of work, when George took my face in his hands and kissed me goodbye. "Oh, I almost forgot, Kath," he said. "Saturday will be our last time at the club before we fly off. I thought I'd have Jake do something special, just for us. Maybe Baked Alaska? You'd like that, wouldn't you?" "You know I would," I smiled. "It's my favorite." I'd been innocent in that moment, uninformed, thinking only of the pleasure it always brought me to be with our friends, George's buddies and their wives who had become my dearest friends. My husband kissed me and pinched my bottom as he left, which both pleased and irritated me. Then the moment he closed the front door and I was alone, I heard the message. "George will kill Bart at the golf course." I grasped the back of a chair to keep from dropping to the floor. It was absurd. The voice had spoken before, but only of things that were of little consequence. Those secret predictions had made me feel smug and special, But this was different. I began to think the other messages had been the setup to this, the main attraction, the way to make me believe it when this one came along to knock the pins out from under me. Closing my eyes, I thought of the brilliant young man I'd married and what fate had in store for him. It simply wasn't fair. And it wasn't right that I knew what would happen and where it would happen. Plus, it was far too little information. I wanted to know when it would happen and, most of all, why it must happen. If the words were true, next Saturday, life as we all knew it would come to an end. The weather had turned hot and muggy, adding to my sense of helplessness and impending doom. The women managed to play in the heat and humidity, and I'd had to work like mad to stay focused. The knowledge that George was to end the life of one of his best friends lay on my heart like a stone. I was put off my game, missing easy shots as I wondered when and how and exactly where it would happen. Would two best friends get into some stupid argument in the heat of the moment, turn their clubs into weapons? There should be something I could do to prevent this tragedy, I thought, but I knew better. The universe was in charge. I had no power to negotiate. After 9 holes, we ladies retired to the showers. We met again in the air-conditioned lounge, where the windows gave view to the perfectly groomed greens. I have to say, this is a really nice place. I have to hand it to them. They did a great job fitting this into the natural landscape, Julie said. Yes, and I'm happy to say they've built their last. I'm so glad they are retiring, Marcia said. Maxine lifted her glass of gin and tonic and swirled the ice. Those guys must be crazy. Still, they're out there playing in this awful heat. A look of understanding passed among us. Those husbands of ours wouldn't let a little thing like a heat wave stop them from playing at least 18 holes. Not here, and undoubtedly in any country. They're like the post office. Neither rain nor sleet or dead of night will keep them from their appointed task or something or other, Marcia giggled. I laughed along with them, but my heart was fluttering with anticipation. Why hadn't they come in? Had it already happened? And Marcia, she had no idea that she was to become a widow. I couldn't breathe. It was too awful. Finally, I saw them as they walked up the steps, sweating and red-faced from too long out in the hot sun. There were 4 of them. I was afraid I would betray my feeling of relief. I wanted to cry. They waved as they made their way to the locker room, from which they would soon emerge, showered and dressed in fresh clothes, ready to get down to some serious eating and drinking. It was to be a celebration. I felt lightheaded. I was so happy. The message had been wrong, I thought, with a rush of extreme well-being. It had to have been wrong. The men had played all 18 holes, and it hadn't happened. As we ordered dinner and drinks and went through our friendly rituals, the fear that had unsettled me all day completely ebbed away. I heard myself laughing at something George said and the idea that somehow he had been fated to kill one of his best friends seemed utterly crazy. By the time we had finished dessert, I was convinced that the universe had entirely slipped up. Here we all were, best friends, eating and drinking together, planning our vacation, our continuing close friendships intact. I put my arm around my inebriated husband as we left the club and made our way to the parking lot. And then we were all waving goodbye, and I was reaching for the driver's side door, when George broke away from me, clicked open the trunk, took out a 9-iron, and yelled, "Hey, Bart, watch this!" The action played out like a 3-second movie. I watched George drop a ball at his feet and take a swing, connect with it. Bart, 20 feet away, turned, let out a little sound of surprise, and fell to the tarmac. I had known it would happen, that nothing I could do would change the result, and then it had. And our world spun out of control. At the last minute, before I could drive us safely away from the golf course, something had driven George to make a silly but deadly point. George swore he couldn't recall what had led to that moment. But to make life even more tragic, his former friends testified against him. They said George and Bart had argued, challenging each other to make impossible shots, pushing at each other as they played the last 3 holes in the stifling heat. Bart had come out with the better score and had rubbed it in. George had laughed, swearing to get even. It had all been in fun until it wasn't. And now George was behind bars. It was 2 months since the verdict was read and our world crumbled around us, but it felt like 20. After each heart-wrenching visit, I would endure my own form of punishment. Stares and whispers and vile, accusing letters pushed under the front door. It was horrifying. How quickly people became corrupted, believing the lies not just of George but of me. The most painful fallout had been the dissolution of our once close friendships and the loss of our place in the community. But we didn't talk about that. I always tried to shield George from what was happening on the outside, putting on my best face when I sat across from him for those precious minutes. But he knew every line. He could see behind the extra makeup under my eyes, the make-believe roses on my cheeks. He wasn't a fool, and without my telling him what was going on, he knew. Today, my husband's frustration at being locked away from me and the real world that had turned against me reached the boiling point. He shouted, "Don't shush me, Kathleen. I won't stand for this. I don't give a damn about those ugly people running around spreading God knows what lies. I don't even care about the house. It's you that matters, only you. You don't deserve the garbage they're throwing at you. You, of all people. I can't believe it. Put the place on the market. Pack up and go." Turning to take a quick look at the guard, he leaned toward me and whispered, "Just do as I say and go. I'll miss you like the devil, but I'll be okay." He smiled, lifting the cloud from his brow. "Look at it this way. You'll always know where I am, and I'll join you just as soon as they open the lid on this can." "Yes, I'm afraid that's what it will take," I said, forcing a smile. "It's only a house." Tears running down my face, I determined to scrub our beautiful home from top to bottom so the new owners wouldn't find even a leftover speck to hold up as dirty evidence against the terrible man and his pathetic wife who had stood by him. I would leave, taking my sins from their midst, and in due time, George would be released and our lives would go on. The cold, faceless business of buying and selling property had been accomplished through the internet. I'd found our new home by looking at video tours and negotiating over the phone. It was a great relief to know we would live on the other side of the country where no one had ever heard of us. The people who purchased what had once been our dream house had heard our story, but rather than being turned off, they had been enticed. It was hard for me to understand what made them tick. Perhaps they thought it would give them an immediate entry into the community where everyone would know who they were and conversation would naturally flow down the gutter again and they would fit right in. But I was being ridiculous. Besides, whatever happened to them, that was their destiny, and we had ours. As I packed up the last of our worldly treasures, the phone rang one last time, a nasty message that made my heart race. But some people have to find someone on whom to spill out their meanness. Not all people, but there were more than enough. In a way, I wasn't their target, but it still broke my heart that when they needed one, they chose me. Taking a deep breath, I returned to my task, glancing at the headline, before folding a newspaper around my favorite serving dish, nesting it in the packing box. It was astonishing, the lies that continued to be printed. But that's what people seem to want, something sensational, as if the truth wasn't sensational enough. But if the truth ever made it into the papers, no one would believe it, because the truth was unbelievable. The truth. As I got into the taxi that would drive me to the airport, some children stuck their tongue out at me while their mother stood by looking at me through narrowed eyes. I closed mine to block the tears that were always ready to spill. Yes, our nightmare had happened, but now it was over. I sat on the wide porch of our house, thousands of miles from the scene of the crime, and watched my husband of 25 years do what he loved best. Bending to address the ball at his feet, he swung the club, sending the orb over the cliff to fall from view. It was a poor excuse for a golf course, but it would do for now, and the eco-friendly ball held no power. It was make-believe, a white puff that would dissolve in the waves below. George balanced a new ball on the tee and, turning toward me, smiled. I blew him a kiss, thinking he still needed my forgiveness. But forgiveness was the wrong word because it certainly wasn't mine to give. Someday he would forgive himself. Still, a man like George would always see himself as the sole creator of his destiny. And I would hold my tongue, even though I knew better. I looked at my watch to see it was nearly 5. In the old days, I'd be stirring up a pitcher of martinis, pulling out a plate of cheese and crackers that would see us through an hour or so until dinner. But cocktail hour was a thing of the past. Now we would sit on the porch and look out at the ocean until the sun had set, a pitcher of sweet lemonade on the table between us, and be glad for each other, and the house and the small vegetable garden, and the calming sound of the waves washing up against the cliffs below. But not today. As the wind picked up, dark clouds gathered to race across the sky. Once again, I heard the voice. It was a terrible burden, knowing what was going to happen, even when it wasn't life-threatening, even when it was something as simple as reading a headline in the newspaper and saying to myself, well, I knew that was going to happen. And it wouldn't do any good to warn against an event, earth-shaking or trivial. It's not in my power, not in anyone's power, to stop what has been decreed. Looks like a big storm is moving in, George, I said, keeping my voice even. Why don't we eat in the den? I'll set up a table in front of the fire. George raised his eyebrows. Sure, if you want to. But I didn't know storms made you that nervous. I smiled and made my voice light. Oh, I think it's just because we haven't lived here long enough to know what to expect. Just humor me, okay? George pulled me close and kissed me. Whatever you need, sweetheart. Whatever you need. I knew he'd give me the moon, if that's what I needed. And thank you was all I could say. It would make no difference if I told him. The wind would still claw at the house until it tore the shingles off the porch. The windows would shatter, shards of glass flying in like a million glittering arrows. Tomorrow, the storm would move on and the sun would come out and life would go on. George had paid his karmic debt, but what about me? I closed my eyes, and there was my mother's face. I could see the fear behind her eyes. Was that it? I wondered. Was that what fate had in store for me? That awful waiting and wondering what would happen? When it would be my turn? The end.